Before we delve into today's episode, I wanted to share a recent favourite binge of mine, Obscure Appalachia. This weekly podcast uncovers eerie and paranormal tales from the Appalachian Mountains, exploring everything from ghosts to cryptids and unexplained experiences. Hosted by Candace, the show takes a deep dive into all things bizarre. Candace has the most soothing voice that's perfect for narrating these chilling stories. In one of her October episodes, she delved into canine cryptids, including hellhounds and werewolves. But my top picks have to be the UFO whistleblowing episode, uncovering secret UFO operations within the US government, and one of her early episodes on Gary Michael Hilton, a serial killer that stalked a national forest. While you're listening, don't forget to subscribe to Obscure Appalachia on all podcast platforms. And be sure to listen through for the special promotion at the end of today's episode.
Okay, who was in the living room with you?
Andrea,
where was your daddy?
In the room with Bree.
What was he doing in the room with Bree?
While it's often said that the most dangerous predators conceal themselves in plain sight, the unsettling reality is that not all these people masquerade as harmless. Some have the convictions to back up their disturbing backgrounds, but still, they can find a way to worm themselves into people's lives. In the year 2020, a mother from Davenport, Iowa, confronted the stark reality that certain individuals can too often remain consistent in their harmful ways. In July 2020, Aisha Lankford reached out to her ex-partner, Henry Earl Dinkins, urging him to spend some time with their 8-year-old son, Detorius. Their relationship had suffered due to Dinkins' recurrent stints in jail and prison. Despite this history, Dinkins accepted the suggestion, and on the 9th of July 2020, he arrived at the home of Aisha's mother. At the time, Aisha's mother was caring for Detorius and Aisha's other two children from previous relationships, including 10-year-old Brazia. Dinkins spent some time chatting with the children and proposed a sleepover to Detorius at his home in the 2700 block of East 53rd Street in Davenport, Iowa, where he lived with his girlfriend, Andrea Cooperson. While Detorius readily agreed, Brazia and her brother, Cordell, expressed their desire to join as well. Considering his cramped one-bedroom apartment, Dinkins hesitated. There was barely enough room for the three of them, never mind two additional children. Dinkins then agreed to allow just Brazia to join them at the sleepover. They climbed into his maroon Chevrolet Impala and headed towards the apartment. Brazia's life began with a challenging start, by impaired hearing and eyesight on her left side. Despite these hurdles, her zest for life still shone through. Alongside her mother, Aisha, and two half-brothers, she navigated life as a resilient fourth grader at Monroe Elementary School, leaving a good impression on her teachers. They couldn't help but praise her infectious smile and her talents on the basketball court. In the absence of her father, Aisha strived to provide a strong, nurturing environment for her children. This was especially important for her son, Dontorius, understanding the significance of a positive male influence in his life. The man who stepped into that role was Henry Earl Dinkins, and he had been a father influence for Brazia, too, and was in her life since she was just a toddler. However, Dinkins bore a checkered history stemming back to 1990. His past read like a catalogue of criminal activity. He had a conviction for third-degree sexual abuse of a child in 1990, as well as violations of sex offender registry rules, instances of assault with a dangerous weapon, domestic violence, drug-related offences, theft, and escapes from the law. His charges even included a murder charge back in 2009, but this was eventually dropped when the detective said that he was just a mere witness. In 2019, a drug-related arrest further stained his record, after police discovered 2 pounds of methamphetamine concealed in his vehicle. He was released on bail for this offence, but he found himself in trouble with law not too long afterwards, when he crashed into a Davenport yard while under the influence of crack. Dinkins was granted early release from prison for that charge in March of 2020. The Iowa Board of Parole granted him parole after determining that he was able and willing to fulfill the obligations of a law-abiding citizen. This was despite the fact that Dinkins was facing felony meth charges. Just 2 days before he picked Brazia and Dontorius up from their grandmother's home, he had indicated in court that he planned on pleading guilty to possession with intent to deliver methamphetamine. This plea would come with a sentence of 8 years in prison, so Dinkins really wanted to see his son before he was sent away for a long time. Once Dottorius and Brazia settled into Dinkins' apartment, he began playing Grand Theft Auto in the living room. Meanwhile, the siblings and Andrea migrated to the single bedroom to chat amongst themselves. When Aisha returned to her mother's home after work, she was informed that Brazia had gone along with her brother to his father's home. She packed her children some pajamas and a spare set of clothing and dropped them over at Dinkins' apartment. When she arrived, Brazia begged her to bring over the family's dog, but Dinkins said no. Aisha returned home alone, and a couple of hours later, she called up Dinkins' cell phone to chat with her children. Brazia said that she was having a good time, while Andrea told Aisha that the children were being well behaved. At about 9 p.m, Dontorius and Brazia had their showers before bed. Brazia took Dinkins' cell phone and texted her mother, "Good night, Mum." Aisha replied, "Good night. I love you, Brie. Thank you." At about 11 p.m, Andrea went to sleep, leaving Dinkins and the children playing video games. At about 3 a.m, Andrea roused from her slumber to use the bathroom. She expected to see Dontorius and Brazia fast asleep in the bedroom, but only Dontorius was there. Andrea ventured into the living room, anticipating to find Brazia and Dinkins asleep on the two sofas, but neither of them were there. Andrea searched the apartment, but she couldn't find either of them. Fumbling in the darkness, she reached for her cell phone, only to find Dinkins' phone charging in the living room. Anxiety knotted her stomach as she paced restlessly, unsure of her next move. With a hushed demeanour, she settled into the living room, careful not to stir Dontorius from his sleep. Moments dragged on until 3:30 a.m., when Dinkins reappeared at the apartment. Brazia wasn't with him, but he was evasive with Andrea, and didn't seem concerned about the girl's absence. Ignoring Andrea's desperate inquiries, he flicked on the lights and lifted something out of the closet. His movements were obscured from her gaze, so she couldn't see what he had retrieved. While he was removing the item, Andrea glanced out of the window, and she saw Brazia standing on the passenger side of Dinkins' maroon Chevrolet Impala. Amidst the unfolding drama, Dontorius had woken. He asked his father where his sister was and began to cry, as his father feigned indifference. Dinkins walked right past his son and Andrea and vanished back outside. From inside, Andrea and Dontorius heard the car's engine hum slowly fade into the distance. Sometime after sunrise, Dinkins returned to the apartment alone. He picked up his cell phone and told Andrea that he was going to search for Brazia. Brazia and Dontorius' mother, Aisha, was working the early morning shift in Checkers and she received a text message from Dinkins at 8:04 a.m. It read, "I just woke up and Brazier's gone." In a panic, Aisha tried to reach Dinkins, and when he finally picked up, he told her that he was on the way to the Davenport Police Department to report her missing. He said that Dontorius was with him, and that they had been searching for Brazier. Abandoning her work duties, Aisha hastily departed for Locust Street, intending to make her way to the police station. As she navigated the streets, a sudden sight froze her in her tracks. It was Dinkins' car whizzing past in the opposite direction. She made a U-turn and followed him towards McDonald's. Aisha got out of her car and screamed at Dinkins, ordering him to give her back Dontorius, who was sitting in the passenger seat. Dinkins tried to explain what happened, but his story was in stark contrast to what Andrea had witnessed in the early morning hours. According to Dinkins, he had woke up that morning to find Brazier missing from their apartment. Something didn't sit right with Aisha. Call it a mother's instinct. So she immediately called 911. Mona Varela was working that morning at the Davenport Police Dispatch Center when the phone call from Aisha came in. She informed her that her daughter had disappeared from her son's father's home sometime in the middle of the night. The first thought that ran through Mona's head was that Brazier was a runaway. The Davenport Police Department had received multiple reports of runaway children in the past, but these disappearances often sort themselves out in just a matter of hours. However, Aisha was adamant that Brazier wouldn't have run away. She had never run away in the past, and she was extremely close with her mother. Brazier was only 10 years old, but she was wise beyond her years. She often sent her mother thoughtful text messages. In one, she told her mother that she was beautiful, and that she wanted to be just like her when she grew up. Aisha provided Mona with Dinkins' cell phone number, and after hanging up, Mona immediately called him. When he picked up, he told her that he had changed his mind about reporting Brazier missing. He said that Brazier was a good kid who never got into trouble. He appeared to be somewhat disoriented. By this point, Aisha had arrived at Dinkins' apartment, and she was frantic with worry. Mona dispatched officers to the apartment before calling up Dinkins again to say that officers were on their way over. He replied that he'd head back there immediately. The first officer to arrive at the apartment was Sergeant Jeffrey Pfeiffer. Something from the offset told him that it wasn't a typical missing child incident. In the parking lot, he came across Aisha, who was in a state of panic.
And Henry lives here?
Yeah, I guess so. This is where he told me to come.
Okay.
He don't even know how long she's even been gone.
Yeah.
Detective Craig Burkle arrived moments later, and as he took Aisha's statement, Dinkins arrived.
What's up, Henry? So when was the last time you saw her?
She was in the house.
Yeah, when was the last time you saw her?
9:30.
Last night?
9:30.
Okay. 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 When was the last time you saw her?
She was in the bed when I woke up.
She was in the bed?
Yeah.
When you went to bed last night? Okay.
This is crazy, man. This is like, you know what I'm saying? I know she fucking going fucking hysterical, big brother.
Yeah. D-I-N.
K-I-N-S.
Is this your home address?
No.
What's your address?
It's down by Boston Carina.
I just
know that.
I don't know your address?
I don't know the full address.
Do you know your phone number?
Hell no. I don't know that either. I swear to God, I don't.
Henry, you don't know where your daughter is. You don't know your address. You don't know your phone number.
No, for real. I'm going to give it to you now.
He described searching for Brazier.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to who have you called? What doors have you knocked on?
I don't know these people out here.
Okay,
you know what I'm saying? But I called her.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
And she told me she was at work. At first, I was riding around looking. And then me and my son started riding around looking.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? And
then, so how long ago did you, has it been an hour?
It's been a couple hours.
A couple hours. Okay.
Aisha and Dinkins began to argue, as Aisha accused him of losing her daughter.
We don't know anybody out here. That's the thing. Okay. She would have never. She was,
how many?
She would have never. First of all, she would have never woke up at 8 o'clock in the morning. She would have never.
What you mean? 8 o'clock in the morning.
I'm just saying.
That ain't what I said. I never said.
Okay,
guys, this isn't the time to fight.
Exactly. I don't give a fuck about you walking, hey, listen, nigga. You lost her though.
How did I fucking lose?
Because you was watching her, Henry. What the fuck do you mean?
But hey,
Dinkins just kept repeating that he woke up and she was gone. As the argument escalated, Aisha walked off. She was returning home to get a photograph of Breasia.
Look, this happens more often than you think. I understand why she's upset. But when I'm trying to help, she can't run away from me.
You can't upset and deal with the issue.
Yes.
You got to keep her level head.
Yeah.
You know that. I learned that a long time ago.
While Aisha was gone, Dinkins took the detective over to the apartment where he spoke to Andrea. She allowed him to come inside and search the apartment for Breasia. There was no sign of her, and when the detective came back outside, Dinkins was gone. He attempted to call him, but received no reply. The search for Breasia immediately began, with detectives canvassing the area. They focused their attention on unoccupied apartments and garages in the complex, but Breasia was nowhere to be seen. Sergeant Pfeiffer recalled, "This incident was clearly not like any other we had experienced, due to the lack of details." As the search continued, detectives tried to get in contact with Dinkins. He finally called them at 12:04 p.m. and said he was heading to the police station. His demeanor over the whole scenario was disturbing to detectives. Breasia was missing, and he decided to disappear as well for several hours. Detective Elizabeth Tharp was on duty at the police station when Dinkins appeared. As he spoke with other detectives, she, along with crime scene technician Jill Foster, were tasked with searching his Impala. At the time, Detective Tharp was 8 months pregnant, and she had an enhanced smell. They decided to check in the trunk, just to see if Breasia was in there. As soon as it was opened, an overwhelming smell of bleach wafted up Detective Thorpe's nose. In the interrogation room, Detective spoke with Dinkins. He said that after the children went to bed, he left the apartment to go over to his cousin Vince's house, but nobody answered. He said he left the apartment and stopped at a Quick Stop to purchase some cigarettes. He said that when he returned, he found Breasia missing from the apartment, so went out searching for her.
What do you do immediately after you notice Breasia's not?
I go outside.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? That's the first thing I did.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? You know, I went outside.
Okay. And then, like, just around the area, or did you get in a car and drive somewhere?
I went around the area first.
Okay.
And then I started moving around, like, trying to get close within the areas. You know what I mean? Trying to look to see if she was walking, you know what I'm saying, or whatever.
And for the sake of, I'm not looking to hand me off on a driving charge. If you went and drove and tried to find her in certain places,
I went in the area where, out there, you know what I'm saying, like trying to see.
Around the apartment complex.
No, like outside, you know what I'm saying, like when I pulled in, I would have seen.
Like those businesses and stuff like that?
No, or? Like the streets.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying, like, you know what I'm
saying. The nearby streets.
I don't know what streets. I mean, I don't. Like, the streets that would go back, the streets that would go forward. You know what I'm saying? It was like by Blockbusters.
Blockbuster. You mean
the video?
Family video.
You know, I call it Blockbusters.
Gotcha.
You know what I'm saying?
But, yep.
He claimed he searched the area on foot before getting into his Impala.
Nothing. Did you, like, just go to bed, or
no? I wasn't
stay in the living room.
I was in the living room. I wasn't even tired.
Yeah.
But I got period, like when I was there, you know, so I periodically checked on them, make sure they was good enough, because we had the air conditioner on, so I had to unplug it because it gets too cold.
Okay.
So I pretty much, you know what I'm saying, like I said, when I realized that. And it's kind of odd because I never known Bree to ever leave, ever. You know what I'm saying? Never, ever leave. I never. It was just odd. You know what I mean? And when I realized it, you know what I'm saying? Like I said, I was looking around. Then when I came back, Andrea was up. She like, what's wrong? I'm like, man, something ain't right. You know what I'm saying? I was freaking out a little bit. So she like, I'm like, man, I'll talk to you in a minute. I gotta figure this shit out. And you know what I'm saying? Because I didn't want her stressing. You know what I'm saying? So.
According to Dinkins, he drove her on various areas searching for Breasia before returning home to pick up his son. He said that he picked up Dontorius and they drove around searching for Breasia.
And then when I came back, I grabbed Dink. You know, and I'm like, man, he like, Dad, where is Bree? I said, I don't know. He's like, and then we rode around and then I texted his mom. When I texted his mom, she was at work and she was like, I'm like, hey, Bree's missing. She's like, well, you stop playing with me. You know what I'm saying? Stop playing with me, Henry. So I'm like, man, no, I'm not playing. I'm for real. And she was like, stop playing with me. I said, look, man, I'm not playing. So I gave Dink the phone. Dink told her, like, mom, you know,
something wasn't sitting right with detectives, so as they interviewed Dinkins, the search for Breasia continued. The search for the little girl had fanned out further afield, and by that evening the lagoon at the entrance to Credit Island Park was searched. Credit Island Park is a Native American trading post, which now serves as a public park with several walking trails. Breasia's family looked on as the lagoon was searched, while evidence technicians searched the north bank. Detectives brought along cadaver dogs, and they picked up a scent of decomposition or blood in a wooded area near the entrance. However, despite the exhaustive search, they didn't find a single thing that could point them in the right direction. The demand for language learning is increasing, with a noticeable spike during the fall, making it an ideal time to delve into new linguistic pursuits. Babbel offers the opportunity to start speaking a new language within just 3 weeks, perfect for showcasing your skills during the holiday season. Instead of investing in expensive private tutors or ineffective language apps that are basically just games, Babbel's brief 10-minute lessons curated by over 150 language experts are tailored to facilitate rapid language acquisition. I've personally experienced the benefits of Babbel during my travels. In Mallorca, I successfully navigated Spanish menus and easily arranged taxis without any issues. Here's a special limited-time deal for Morbidology listeners to get you started right now. Get 55% off your Babbel subscription, but only for Morbidology listeners, at babbel.com/morbidology. Get 55% off at babbel.com/morbidology, spelled babbel.com/morbidology. Rules and restrictions may apply. As soon as Breasia's disappearance hit the media, rumours began running rampant across social media. People dug up Dinkin's criminal record and began suggesting that he was involved in Breasia's disappearance. It wasn't just people across social media who were suspicious. Detectives were already looking at him as a person of interest. Once Detective Thorpe mentioned the strong smell of bleach in the trunk of his vehicle, Dinkins was arrested. That morning, he should have registered as a sex offender, but he had failed to do so, which warranted his arrest. Oftentimes when detectives have a person of interest but not enough evidence, they will arrest them on other charges. Furthermore, Dinkins hadn't reported the location on East 53rd Street as his residence, as per the sex registry requirements. His residence was listed as a mobile home on Schmidt Road, where he had previously lived before moving in with his girlfriend. By now, detectives had interviewed both Dinkins and Andrea, but there was another person in the apartment that night, 8-year-old Dontorius. Detectives decided to speak to him to see if he could offer any further insight into what happened to his older sister. He recounted how their father had picked them up and brought them to his apartment that afternoon.
I know that your daddy picked you up last night, is that right?
Yeah.
Where'd he pick you up from?
My nana?
Your nana.
The thing was, it's good. There's you from number one.
Okay. And was he always just going to pick only you up? Was that what he was originally going to do? Just pick you up?
Yeah.
And then what happened when Dad got there?
He told me to brush my teeth, and then my sister came. He said she don't mind if he come.
Did she want to go with him? Okay. And was Grandma there?
Yep. But my nana told her don't go, and she went.
Okay, so she wanted to go. So Grandma said don't go, and she went.
Yep.
And what'd your dad say when Grandma said don't go?
Well, all he said was come on. Let's go.
He said, come on, let's go. And where did you sit in that car?
Front seat.
Front seat?
He said that sometime after he arrived, he was playing Grand Theft Auto with Andrea while his father took Brescia into the bedroom alone.
Okay, who was in the living room with you?
Andrea,
where was your daddy?
In the room with Bree.
What was he doing in the room with Bree?
Well, what did I say again, Mom?
Well, just think. Use your brain. What was he doing? Was he sleeping?
No.
Was the door open?
Yeah.
Door was open? Okay. Well, is there a game in there?
Oh, I just forgot he was playing the game with me.
He was what?
Playing the game.
What game?
It's a jumping game.
A jumping game? Okay. So he wasn't playing with you, he was playing with her.
Yeah.
Okay. Were you sad that he was playing with her and not you?
Yeah.
Okay, you were?
Yep, I was mad.
You were mad? Why were you mad?
Because he didn't play the game with me.
Okay.
Despite their mother providing them with pajamas for the night, both of them had been handed t-shirts to wear to bed after showering. Dontorius recalled sensing somebody kick his leg in the middle of the night. While he had shared a bed with his sister previously, she had never done this before. He fell back asleep, only to awaken to find Brescia missing and his father gone.
We was playing the game for a little bit more, and then we went to bed, and when I woke up, I saw her feet kick me. Uh-huh. And then I woke up, and then she was gone.
Okay. When you say you saw her, were you in the same bed as your sister?
Yeah.
And was that the room with the air conditioner? Okay. And where was your daddy at?
In the living room.
And where was he at in the living room?
On the air mattress.
With who?
His girlfriend.
Okay. When you went to bed, your daddy was on the air mattress?
Mm-hmm. And when I woke up, both of them was gone.
Okay.
By this point, Andrea was awake, and Dontoria said that she was looking out of the window. Dontorius told detectives that just as day broke, his father returned to the apartment. He was acting strange and grabbed something out of the closet before leaving again. According to Dontorius, his father returned a second time and left again before returning for a third time. Dontorius said that when his father returned for a third time, he bundled him into his car and drove him to Clinton, where they stopped at a Walmart. He watched as his father removed the battery from his cell phone, but when he was left alone in the car while his father went into Walmart, he put it back in so that he could play a game. When Dontoria saw his father returning to the car, he quickly removed the battery from the cell phone. From here, Dontoria said they returned to Davenport and stopped at locations near Credit Island. Dontoria recounted how his father exited the car and ventured into a wooded area. From here, they drove over to Dinkins' mobile home on Schmidt Road, and Dontorius watched on.
So you saw him grab a bleach and knife out?
Yeah.
Where were you at when he was fishing?
I was in the car.
I know, but
and
where was
we
he?
When we went back to his house, he forgot something. He went in the house to grab his big old knife, and then he put it in his trunk.
Okay. So let me talk.
What color? It's purple.
It's purple? Okay. Where did he grab that knife from?
His trunk.
His trunk?
And then he washed it off.
He washed off what?
The knife.
Washed it off with what, though?
Some bleach and a rag.
According to Don Torres, his father had a knife that he cleaned with bleach. Afterwards, they returned to the apartment in Davenport, where Brazier was finally reported missing. The suspicions against Dinkins were mounting, yet he refused to change his story. The search continued and Brazier's family asked for assistance in the search, with her mother, Aisha, stating, "She's been gone 24 hours. She's a 10-year-old girl. I'm asking anyone to come help me." In an effort to get some much-needed leads, Crime Stoppers of the Quad Cities offered a $3,500 cash reward for information that could lead to Brazier. The weekend passed in a blur for Brazier's loved ones, but come Monday morning they were back out searching again. The community came out in droves to help search for the little girl, combing through the wooded areas of Credit Island. Don Torres said that he stopped there with his father sometime during the drive that morning. Among the searchers was a local woman named Connie Snyder, who commented in the media, "I have a 10-year-old son. If he went missing, I hope people would get together and try to help me find him." That same day, detectives finally publicly announced that Dinkins was considered a person of interest in the case. They asked if anybody had any information regarding his whereabouts from 10 p.m. on July 9th until noon on July 10th to get in contact. They released a photograph of him to the public, as well as three vehicles that he was associated with, including a Chevy Impala, a Chevy Camaro, and a 1980 motorhome. His motorhome was located on Schmidt Road, and it was where Dinkins had been living before he moved in with Andrea. It was just a stone's throw away from Credit Island, where the sniffer dogs had detected human decomposition or blood. Detectives obtained a search warrant for the mobile home, and when they searched it, they came across a machete on top of the refrigerator. It matched the description of the knife that Don Torres had described. To try and learn more, detectives decided to call in two cadaver dogs, Rocky and Jojo. Inside the motorhome, they detected the scent of human decomposition or blood. It had now been 3 days since Brazier was last seen, and detectives had enlisted the help of the FBI. Dinkins was being held in the Scott County Jail, and while the search for Brazier continued, he asked her mother, Aisha, to meet him at the jail. She did, hoping that he could tell her where her daughter was. However, when she arrived, he promised her that he had nothing to do with the disappearance of her daughter. He appeared to be overcome with emotion and broke down into tears. Aisha thought that this was kind of strange. She had known Dinkins for over a decade, and she had never once seen him emotional, let alone seen him cry. He then accused her of dragging him into her daughter's disappearance, despite the overwhelming amount of circumstantial evidence. Aisha didn't believe Dinkins, and she made her thoughts public, asserting, "I believe he knows something about what is happening with my daughter. I think my daughter is alive, and I think it's just a matter of time before Dinkins is ready to crack and tell what he knows." Yet her own struggles intensified as she faced unwarranted attacks on social media. People began questioning her capabilities as a mother, and even insinuating her complicity in her daughter's disappearance. Addressing the situation, she remarked, "All of a sudden the search for a little girl is stuff about whether I'm a good mom. Even if people think I'm worthless, they should still care about what happens to Brazier." Amidst the growing speculation, Aisha refuted the accusations against her. She emphasized the emotional toll her daughter's disappearance had taken on her. She commented, "I feel empty, like just empty. People want to know why I'm not crying all the time. I have nothing. My daughter is gone and no one seems to know anything, and I have no idea how I feel. I have to have hope." Aisha still strongly believed that her daughter was alive. She said that when she closed her eyes, she could see her daughter's face and hear her voice. It was like Brazier was calling out to her to come and find her. The following day, an Amber Alert was issued, providing a detailed description of Brazier, who stood at 4 feet 5 inches tall and weighed approximately 75 pounds. Detectives then publicly announced that they now believe the Dinkins had kidnapped Brazier. As they continued investigating the case, detectives began looking at surveillance footage in the locations that Detorius had mentioned. Cameras showed that at about 2:13 a.m. on the night Brazier disappeared, Dinkins arrived in his Impala at his mobile home on Schmidt Road. He left the mobile home and headed south at about 2:29 a.m. He returned to the mobile home just minutes later and then left to head to Credit Island at 2:49 a.m. At about 3:31 a.m., Dinkins was caught on surveillance getting out of the red Impala at a quick stop in Davenport. The vehicle was seen on multiple surveillance cameras that morning, heading north to Clinton County in Iowa and within the city limits of Clinton. He returned to the apartment at some stage and picked up his cell phone, but it remained switched off until 7:04 a.m. when he and Dontorius arrived at Walmart. Inside the store, Dinkins was captured on surveillance footage, purchasing 2 bottles of bleach. From here, surveillance showed he travelled back to his mobile home on Schmidt Road, before returning to Andrea's apartment. The next morning, detectives shifted their focus in the search for Brazier to Clinton County, around 40 miles away. The cell phone data and surveillance footage at Walmart had placed Dinkins here before he reported Brazier missing, so it seemed like a natural place to search. They were working on the theory that he had done something to Brazier and then disposed of her body. They began canvassing fields and using drones overhead in search of some kind of clue to show they were in the right direction. However, by Friday, it had been a week since Brazier had disappeared, but there hadn't been a single reported sighting of her. Aisha was at the forefront of the search in Clinton County, and she commented that she would search anywhere to bring her daughter home. That afternoon, the search had to be cut short due to the extreme heat, but the next morning, everybody was out searching again. Hundreds of members of the community came out to participate in the search in Clinton County, while others made sure that the searchers were well fed and watered. Mike and Shill Hunter, who owned Watt Barbecue and Bar, provided 120 meals for the volunteers. As Mike said, "We knew we didn't have the time to donate to go search. We figured this would be a way we could help out and assist." Despite the passage of time, detectives announced on the 20th of July that they still hoped Brazier was alive. That day, they called off the organized search in Clinton County and said they were focusing on following up on different leads. The investigation continued over in Davenport, and the FBI raised the reward fund to $10,000. It was then increased just days later to $13,500. On the 24th of July, Dinkins was hit with more charges, but these didn't relate to Brazier's disappearance. Instead, he was charged in relation to meth trafficking. This continued the manufacture and delivery of more than 200 grams of amphetamine, or an analogue of methamphetamine, and 1 count of delivery of more than 900 grams of methamphetamine. Both of these are Class X felonies under the Illinois law, that carries a prison sentence of 6 to 30 years. As autumn sets in and Thanksgiving approaches, it's time to grab your seasonal decorations. The familiar struggle of locating the right storage bin can be a thing of the past. Introducing Smart Labels, your solution for hassle-free organization. No more opening multiple bins, making a mess, and feeling frustrated. With Smart Labels, easily locate your items within your storage bins. How does it work? Simply purchase their color-coded and QR-coded Smart Labels from their website, Amazon, or Walmart. Then download the Smart Labels app from the Apple App Store or Google Play. Attach the Smart Label to your storage bin, scan it with the app, and assign a specific name such as Thanksgiving. You can even describe the contents for easy reference. Say goodbye to spending precious time rummaging through boxes to find your Thanksgiving or fall decorations. Visit qrsmartlabels.com now to simplify your storage organization. Just before August drew to a close, Breja's presence in the news cycle of Davenport had diminished. The headlines had shifted focus, delving into the COVID-19 spread, police reform concerns, and the aftermath of a powerful storm that left thousands without power. Amidst the return to normalcy for many, the tour boats resumed operations at Credit Island, marking the resumption of everyday life. In the initial days, the island had been inundated with missing person flyers, adorned with Breja's face, yet they had all vanished, either washed away by the rain or torn down by the relentless winds. While detectives continued their painstaking investigation, a few steadfast individuals persisted in their quest to find Breja. Expressing the community sentiment, an anonymous local working at QC Mart reflected, "I can't give you my name because of company policy, but I can tell you, I look for that little girl every time a car pulls up. It's like people have moved on. That's really sad." Despite the prevailing belief in Dinkins' involvement in Breja's disappearance, the community seemingly resigned itself to the situation, carrying on with their lives as he remained behind bars. In stark contrast, Breja's family found themselves trapped in an unending moment, unable to move forward without discovering the fate of Breja. Dinkins' sister Nida and his mother Helen shared their thoughts on the case at the end of the month. They both said that they wholeheartedly believed that he had nothing to do with Breja's disappearance. Nita said that they were out of town on the morning of the 10th of July, when they received a phone call from Dinkins, saying that Breja had vanished. She recollected, "I told them to call the police right away." They slammed the detective, saying that they had taken away their cell phones and kicked in their front door, despite the fact they gave detectives permission to search their home. Nita then made some darker allegations, stating, "We heard there's a hit out on Henry Dinkins, me, my mother, and other members of our family. A murder contract. One day there was an SUV following us, so we called 911, and we were pretty upset. I was very afraid of what was going to happen. The dispatcher told us that the police would get to us when they get to us. I just feel like we are being held responsible for something we had nothing to do with." The investigation continued to drag on, and before Breja's family knew it, it was November, and they were still no closer to finding her. On the 14th, Aisha joined supporters in a march to raise community awareness to her daughter's disappearance. She held up a poster filled with photographs of her daughter and demanded answers. They braved the freezing cold temperatures and rain, but things turned sour. Aisha stated to one of the reporters who had attended the march, "Some people who weren't near us got into the traffic on the road and handed out flyers. And the police rolled up to our group and started warning us. It was just weird. There was a weird vibe when we got here, and we feel like the police are following us around. So we're just going to leave." Since her daughter disappeared, Aisha had been filling pages of lined notebook paper with thoughts of her daughter. She was clinging to every single memory of her, hoping that she could share it with her whenever she came back home. Breja's 11th birthday came and went on the 4th of December, but she was noticeably absent. To mark the event, the FBI posted a plea on their Twitter page asking for information. Another 6 months would pass until the fate of Breja would finally be unearthed. On the evening of the 22nd of March 2021, Brendan Rogue, Jesse Dow, and Eric Johnson were fishing in a pond in a rural area near DeWitt in Clinton County, about 20 miles north of Davenport. They had traversed their way up the yellow dirt road and began walking towards the pond. As they drew closer, something white in the foliage in the distance caught their eye. Brendan thought that it looked like a skull, and at first, he thought that somebody had left a fake skeleton to scare any passerbys. However, a grim realization began to take hold. Brendan asked Eric, "Is that a real skull? Is this some kind of joke?" They got closer to the object and Eric picked it up, before immediately dropping it back down. It was a real human skull. There was black hair attached to it, braided with small seashells. The men immediately called 911 and detectives arrived at the scene, along with forensic experts and a pathologist. The roads surrounding the pond were closed off as forensic experts began their investigation. In addition to the human skull, they came across an elbow, one hand, ribs, a right toe, a left leg, and a foot bone. The grim search continued, and beside the skeletal remains, they came across two bullets, portions of a shirt, and shoes. The body was transported to the medical examiner's office for a cause of death to be determined, and for an identification to be made. While identification couldn't be made by sight alone, it was evident that the skull was that of a child. The special agent in charge, Richard Rann, announced to the media, "We simply don't have much information right now. We don't know if those are the remains of a man or woman, or how old that person might be." Aisha was immediately informed of the discovery, although she was told it would take a while for identification to be made. Other families who had missing loved ones were made aware as well. As for Aisha, she immediately made her way over to the area, getting as close to the pond as she could. She stood there alone, hoping to catch a glimpse of something that would tell her whether the body discovered was that of her daughter. Over at the medical examiner's office, the body was positively identified as Brasia Terrell via dental records. Her remains showed three distinct bullet wounds, one to the left jawbone and two to the right shoulder. In announcing the identification, Davenport Police Chief Paul Sikorsky stated, "This news is heartbreaking to both Brasia's family and our Davenport community. Our deepest sympathies and heartfelt prayers are with those affected by this tragic loss." The location where Brasia was found quickly turned into a makeshift memorial. Members of the community placed flowers, teddy bears, and a bright orange basketball along the banks of the pond. For the past 8 months, thousands of people had driven past the path that meandered its way to the isolated pond, but it never crossed anybody's mind that a little child's body was decomposing down there. One local woman, Margaret Zimmerman, commented, "My heart just sank when I heard they found a body. I think most of us knew it was Brasia. We didn't want it to be her, but that's a hard thing too, because it's going to be someone's child, someone who was loved and missed." But she said that the entire of eastern Iowa felt the same way. Brasia's missing person posters had extended the confines of Davenport, making their way to other parts of Iowa. As news of the identification went throughout the community, detectives heard from a man named Jared Brink. He said that at 4:30 a.m. on the morning Brasia disappeared, he helped a black man pull his maroon Impala from a ditch near the site where her body was ultimately found. Detectives pulled the GPS data from Jared's phone, which confirmed that he was in the area when he said he was. Then on the 5th of May, there was a massive development in the case.
This morning, Henry Earl Dinkins was charged in the death of 11-year-old Brasia Terrell. These charges are the result of a 9-month investigation by the Davenport Police Department and numerous other agencies.
Henry Dinkins was charged with first-degree murder and first-degree kidnapping in the death of Brasia. The circumstantial evidence against him had been mounting, but in addition to that, detectives had discovered some ominous information. In the days leading up to Brasia's disappearance, Dinkins had been searching online for violent pornographic images. Among the images he searched for were those depicting the sexual abuse in young black children. Detectives believe that he had abducted Brasia with the intention to sexually abuse her, and then killed her to prevent her from telling anybody. He had previous crimes against children, and his search history showed that these dark thoughts still lingered. On the 17th of June, Dinkins pleaded not guilty to the kidnapping and murder charges. The case was making its way through the justice system when Dinkins requested a new attorney in February of 2022. He had written a letter to the judge asking for a new attorney, despite the fact his trial was scheduled for that same month. In the letter, he said he hadn't seen his public defender, Miguel Fuentes, more than one time in 8 months. He also accused the attorney of giving him false phone numbers and claimed that he couldn't get in contact with him. He concluded the letter with, "I'm asking the courts to give me someone that's willing to help me fight this case." The judge denied Dinkins' request and said he needed to work out his differences with his attorney. He pointed out to Dinkins that the attorney he had was a very good one, with a lot of trial experience. Nevertheless, Dinkins was adamant that he wanted a new attorney, and the following month he made another request. He also said that if he couldn't get a new attorney, he wanted to represent himself in his upcoming murder trial. Once more, his requests were denied by the judge. But afterwards, Dinkins' own defense attorney requested to be removed from the case. He said that each time he tried to call Dinkins in jail, he refused to accept the phone calls. The request was approved, which pushed the case back further. It was pushed back a little further after it was decided that the trial venue needed to be moved. The trial was moved to Linn County. In April, Dinkins was assigned a new defense attorney, Jennifer and Chase Freese. The murder trial was pushed back several more times. It was scheduled to begin in August, but on the 8th of that month, Dinkins opted for a bench trial. That meant that a judge instead of a jury would hear the case. It also meant that the trial could be brought back to Scott County. Before the trial began on the 10th of August 2023, Aisha spoke with Local 4 News. She commented, "It's nerve-wracking a bit. It's emotional. It means everything to me right now because I've been waiting for this day. I've been waiting for 3 years. 3 long years. I've been through the most. My son has been through the most, and we're here. I'm so happy to finally be here because I can't wait until she gets the justice that she deserves." The trial began on the 10th of August 2023. During opening statements, the prosecution put forward their theory that Dinkins had taken Brazier from the apartment to sexually assault her at his mobile home on Schmidt Road. The defense team countered this and said that no evidence connected Dinkins to Brazier's murder. The first witness to testify was Mona Valera, the 911 operator. She explained the phone calls made that morning. She was asked by defense attorney Chad Freese whether Dinkins was polite, respectful, and sounded normal on the phone. She replied that he did. She also confirmed that while speaking with Aisha that morning, she never expressed any concern that Dinkins was somehow involved in her daughter's disappearance. She then added, "To me, that's what's so alarming. Everyone was sounding normal." The judge also heard from the responding officers, who testified that something told them that this wasn't just an average missing child case. The testimony then shifted to forensic evidence. Sergeant Jeffrey Pfeiffer said that a 4XL t-shirt was discovered beside Brazier's remains. She had been dressed in a 4XL t-shirt before she went to bed at Dinkins' home. The defense then revealed that a bloody child's t-shirt was discovered in the trunk of a car, involved in another homicide that was committed in Clinton 10 days after Brazier disappeared. Sergeant Pfeiffer said that this evidence was never considered in connection to Brazier's disappearance. The defense team suggested that this evidence was never tested, but Sergeant Pfeiffer corrected him. He said that the child's bloody t-shirt was tested, and the blood didn't match Brazier's. The defense team were clearly trying to imply that this other murder may have been connected with Brazier's disappearance, but evidence proved that it wasn't. Defense attorney Freese then asked whether Brazier's blood was ever found in Dinkins' vehicles or his mobile home, but he was informed that it wasn't. The sergeant was then asked whether any evidence of Brazier, including hair, blood, or fluids, was discovered in the case. Once again, he said no. There was no physical evidence found in the case at all, including on the machete that Dontoria said he saw his father cleaning. There was none found in the apartment, the mobile home, or any of the vehicles that Dinkins had owned. While there was no direct evidence, testimony was presented about the cadaver dogs, detecting human decomposition or blood, at both Credit Island and Dinkins' mobile home. These are two locations that Dontorius told detectives his father had taken him that morning. Further evidence was presented in the form of surveillance footage and cell phone records, which showed Dinkins driving to and through various locations the night Breja disappeared. What stuck out was that at some stage during the early morning hours, Dinkins had changed his clothes and shoes. A geologist from the FBI's Trace Evidence Unit also testified that dirt found under Dinkins' car could be linked to the dirt from the road near where Breja's body was found. Further testimony corroborated the prosecution's assertion that Dinkins was guilty, including the testimony of Jared Brink. Unfortunately, Jared had died from a heart attack at the age of 48, so his deposition needed to be presented. He described helping a black man pull his maroon Impala from a ditch not too far away from where Breja's body was ultimately found. Dinkins drove a maroon Impala. Both Aisha and Andrea testified during the murder trial. Andrea said that when she woke up to find both Breja and Dinkins missing from the apartment, she felt sick to her stomach. She described Dinkins returning to the apartment at about 3:30 a.m., adding the disturbing detail of Breja standing outside beside his vehicle. She was asked how she knew that it was Breja, and she replied, "Her hair was very distinctive, and there was that gigantic t-shirt she was wearing." The most highly anticipated moment of the trial came when Dontorius testified against his father. He spoke about waking up to find his father and Breja gone. He said that his father returned and then left again twice, before returning for a third time. In a soft tone, he told the courtroom, "He came for me."
When you got to the dirt road, what happened?
We was at this place, what is it called? It had like trees.
Did the vehicle stop?
Yeah.
Then what happened?
And then we left too.
Did anybody get out of the car at that time?
Henry.
When Henry got out of the car, what did you see him do?
Pour bleach.
You saw him pour bleach?
Yeah.
Dontorius returned to the witness stand the next day, and he made an explosive confession. He testified that his father had taken both him and Breja out in the car in the early morning hours. He said that he drove them to a wooded area, and that he watched his father shoot Breja.
What do you recall?
What do I recall?
You obviously recall that Andrea wasn't there, so you recall facts. What do you recall?
Us three there.
At the location where Breja was killed?
Yes.
Okay. You didn't testify to that today, right?
Yes.
Because that's not true, right?
If you say it's not true.
I'm asking you.
I guess.
I guess, or either it is or it isn't. Either you were there when she was killed or you weren't.
I said, I guess.
I don't accept that answer, sir. Either you were there when she was shot or you weren't.
I was there. Damn.
So you were there?
Yes.
You saw your dad shoot Breja Terrell?
Yes.
Okay. And how come you didn't say that when the prosecutor asked you? Because it's not the truth, right?
Everything I say is true.
Okay, so the whole story about the bloody knife and going to Walmart, you just conveniently left out the fact that you saw your sister get shot when the prosecutor was asking you?
I didn't leave it out. I didn't speak about it. I hate speaking about it.
Dontorius was then cross-examined by Scott County Assistant Prosecutor Liz O'Donnell.
Dee, when was the last time that you saw Breja?
We was at Andrea's house.
And was she in the bedroom at that time?
Yes.
Did you ever see her again after that?
That last time.
The last time?
Yeah.
When was the last time?
when she got shot.
Were you afraid to tell people that you saw her get shot?
Yes, I was.
Why?
Because it's hard to talk about.
Were you scared?
No.
Were you worried you might get in trouble?
Somewhat like that.
After Dontorius' testimony, the judge then heard from two of Dinkins' cellmates, David Barker and Matt Dean. David testified that sometime in October 2020, they were watching the news when a story about the search for Breasia aired.
The news story came on and broadcasted that they were continually looking for her, and he would state that they were never going to find her.
Dinkins later spoke to Matt about the case, telling him that he wasn't involved, but that a woman involved in sex trafficking was involved. He then added, they're never going to find her. Following the presentation of the testimony, Dinkins' defense team filed a motion, calling for all charges against him to be dismissed. They said that the state had failed to show any compelling evidence linking him to the murder. Judge Latham rejected the motion after the prosecution cited back all of the circumstantial evidence against Dinkins. Closing arguments were then presented, during which defense attorney Chad Fries pointed out that the state had no direct evidence against him. He called Breasia's murder an execution and said, someone stood close to her and pulled that trigger. 1, 2, 3 times. That takes a special kind of person. That person was not Henry Dinkins. In the prosecution's closing arguments, Liz O'Donnell stated, this was a horrific act committed by a horrific person. The defense is right. This was an execution. Imagine the fear she felt as she was led to those woods. She knew she was going to die. She said that evidence showed Dinkins and Breasia were missing from the apartment from at least 3 a.m. However, surveillance footage showed Dinkins traveling north on Schmidt Road at 2:13 a.m. and he spent some time here before leaving and then returning again. She questioned why Dinkins would have taken Breasia from the apartment to a location she didn't know unless he had nefarious motivations. Without mincing her words, she said, his actions speak to his intent. This child was sexually assaulted. The judge returned with a verdict on the 15th of September and called everybody back to court. Judge Latham read through a long description of the evidence, pausing at times to regain his composure. He then found Henry Earl Dinkins guilty of the murder of Breasia Terrell. As he was led from the courtroom, spectators erupted into cheers. Outside of court, Aisha spoke with the media. Through tears, she said, I talk with Breasia all the time, every day. Sometimes I go to the place they found her. Sometimes I go to that mural up on the hilltop. Sometimes I'm just sitting somewhere. I always apologize. I told her I'm sorry for what happened. I told her I'm sorry I didn't protect her, that I wasn't there to protect her. I always told her I was going to do my best to make sure she gets justice. Today, I'm going to tell Breasia she won. Today, I get to tell her that the judge said her little brother helped the police solve this case. Finally, today, I finally get to tell my baby that her brother was there for her. The following month, she returned to court to learn Dinkins' sentence. But first, victim impact statements were presented. Aisha took her place at the podium. She said that closure and justice do not exist in the case before adding, you took away everything.
I have a number of questions for you, Henry Dinkins, surrounded that night that played through my mind every day. Did she want me? Was she scared? Did she see those gunshots coming? Did you shoot her while she was trying to get away? Did she scream for help? Did she beg you to stop? Did you see in her face when she realized she was shot the first time? What was her last words? Did you stay and watch my baby die? How long did she suffer? Did you watch the life leave from her beautiful hazel eyes? What did you do to my son? Why? Do you know the answers?
Aisha said that since the day her daughter disappeared, she had doubted herself as a mother and questioned what else she could have done. She said that their son, Don Torius, had become a shadow of himself, almost becoming unrecognizable.
I watched my youngest baby. I watched my youngest baby become unrecognizable. At times, with the amount of anger he sits and holds to from this trauma you put him through, he's so hurt he has no idea how to even understand or even cope with the loss of his best friend, partner in crime, his sister, who helped him through so much of his life. He will too overcome this and gain himself back and be somebody. He will not be what you have put him through or even made him sit through.
Henry Jenkins was also allowed to provide a statement, and he claimed that he was railroaded by detectives. He said that while his defense team had done their best, they overlooked some things in the case. He then addressed his son.
My dearest son, you know I love you with all my heart. I know everybody distorted your thoughts where you're trying to figure things out in your own head. I'm sorry that you had to deal with all this abuse from those who made you lie about all these stories. I know you remember me, you, and Bree counting money on the mattress up to $2,000. I was so proud of you because you was a fast learner. I know you are mad because you believe I lost your sister, but guess what? Your dad ain't mad at you behind the lies. I love you more than the lies. I know one day you will tell the truth, but even if you don't, I'll still love you regardless.
Henry Earl Dinkins was then sentenced to 2 life terms. He was also ordered to pay $150,000 in restitution to Aisha. Brescia Tyrrell, seemingly under the protection of her half-brother's father, should have been safe. However, as the old saying warns, a leopard never changes its spots. Henry Dinkins had a history of perpetrating one crime after another. He seemingly refused to reform, and tragically, it was Brescia who paid the ultimate price. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say a massive thank you to my newest supporter up on Patreon, Robert. If you'd like to support Morbidology on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. Alternatively, you can download the app and search for Morbidology, or do the same on desktop. In exchange for your support on Patreon, I upload bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast feeds. I also upload ad-free and early release episodes, Behind the Scenes, which includes bonus audio, video and case files, and I also send out some cool exclusive merch, along with a handwritten thank you card. As you all know, Morbidology is just a one-woman team, so the support on Patreon seriously goes such a long way. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read some true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Here in the hills of Appalachia, things aren't what they seem. Join me as I tell y'all stories of hauntings, cryptids, aliens, and everything unexplained in these mountains. Obscure Appalachia is a bi-weekly, true paranormal storytelling podcast. You can find Obscure Appalachia wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm Candace, and I'll be your guide.